Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, February 12th.
We have been told by some that you must either be for revolution or you are for the status quo. But where does that leave the rest of us? Most Americans don't see where they fit in that polarized vision. And we can't defeat the most divisive president in modern American history by tearing down anybody who doesn't agree with us 100% of the time.
At this point in the campaign, we are taking on billionaires and we're taking on candidates funded by billionaires.
Donald Trump's worst nightmare is that the people in the middle, the people who have had enough of the name calling and the mudslinging, have someone to vote for in November.
Vote Amy B. Trump. Vote Amy B. Trump.
The three biggest winners from last night's New Hampshire primary returns. From their victory speeches, Bernie Sanders got 26% of the vote. Pete Buttigieg got 24%. Amy Klobuchar exceeded expectations by getting 20%. Elizabeth Warren, yikes, just 9% of the vote. And Joe Biden, triple yikes, just 8%, and others on down from there. Andrew Yang and Michael Bennett, if you haven't heard, dropped out. A top Michael Bloomberg campaign official tweeted that Yang would make an interesting candidate for New York City mayor. That election is next year. Apparently, Team Bloomberg is still trying to defeat top New York City Democrats like they did for 12 years, even as he runs for the Democratic presidential nomination. But back to the presidential nomination. Spring training is over, right? I mean, this is a clear line. The two small and unrepresentative states of Iowa and New Hampshire are now behind us, and now it gets real. Nevada's Democratic electorate is about a quarter Latino. South Carolina's is majority black. And then come Super Tuesday with California, Texas, Virginia, and other big-time, big-population, very diverse states. It's not just that Iowa and New Hampshire always going first may be unfair to most Americans. It's also that they are just such an unscientific sample of the country, so unrepresentative of the overall electorate in primaries or generals. Buttigieg and Klobuchar start with close to zero people of color support in national polls. Bernie Sanders has about 20%, and there are looming Steyer and Bloomberg factors out there as well. With me now to look ahead is Michael Eric Dyson, Georgetown professor, New York Times contributing opinion writer, and author of books, including his latest, Jay-Z, Made in America. Professor Dyson, always great to have you. Thank you for coming on today.
Always great to be on with you, my friend.
Let's start here. Considering Joe Biden's collapse in the first two states, what does that do to the thinking of South Carolina voters who are supposed to be his firewall?
Well, I think that people have already anticipated beneath the Mason-Dixon line that Joe Biden will have a kind of revival, a Billy Graham Sunday morning revival. And the hope, of course, of his camp is that the enormous black support that he has garnered so far, that has been loyal to him and oblivious or at least impervious to any charges of his incompetence or his aging out or his unfitness for office, I think will shift the narrative of this quite considerably. On the one hand, you know, the first two in Iowa and New Hampshire can be dismissed as overwhelmingly white, unrepresentative polls of populations that will not be the determining factor in this presidential race. However, obviously, you know, rural whites and whites in smaller municipalities make a difference, have a voice, should exercise some influence. But I think that Joe Biden is counting heavily and his campaign are counting heavily on a resuscitation, so to speak, of the body of his campaign. And I think that, you know, when we see Super Tuesday, when we see South Carolina, I think that Joe Biden will be in a much stronger position.
You do. Because after Iowa, after just Iowa, before last night, Biden tanked in black support in the latest Quinnipiac poll nationally from 52% of black Democrats to 27%. Yeah. That's compared to just, you know, 2 weeks ago. Does that stat not ring true to you?
Well, it certainly should be concerning. You know, you don't want to dismiss it as a Disraeli-like lies, damn lies, statistics and polls. Mm. But it is concerning to be sure, because, you know, black support for Mr. Biden, Vice President Biden, is premised on appreciation for what he has done in his what he did in his time with Barack Obama, his stalwart defense of Obama, and his willingness to be his advocate, his substitute, and in some cases, his henchman. And so he's garnered such goodwill that I think that that may at least mitigate some of the damaging consequence of this new poll, or at least what it points to. But I think at the same time, they've got to be somewhat concerned. Black voters are extremely practical. They want somebody who's able to win, who carries a kind of moral influence that is resonant within these communities. But at the end of the day, like most other Democrats, they want somebody who can beat Trump.
If you're Buttigieg or Klobuchar, how do you start from scratch with voters of color to try to earn votes?
Yeah, well, just don't make any tapes that get circulated where you're talking about black neighborhoods and stop and frisk.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
You know, right. But obviously, you've got to reach out and suggest that, look, especially in Mayor Pete's case, you know, I've got some negatives against me. The firing of a police chief, not following briskly to manage a racial crisis by putting in place somebody else who could speak more directly to the issues, not having been historically sensitive to the plight and predicament of African-American people. But I'm here now. I get the issue. I get the point. I failed in the past, but I'm willing to try now. Black people are extremely forgiving people. And I think if Buttigieg comes with that message, I think he can redeem his campaign. As far as Klobuchar, you know, the senator from Minnesota has to, in a similar fashion, suggest that, you know, she's already done some work that may not be as well known within Minnesota, that, you know, with its burgeoning African population there and a variety of ethnicities within African identity, that she has forged connections and made, you know, inroads with those sorts of population. And then she could argue that her moderate approach matches the kind of, you know, moderate moral outlook that many inherently conservative black communities have. They may vote Democratic, but many of them hold views that most likely align with conservative interests. And had the Republican Party not been so vehemently denunciatory of many black interests and identities, they could garner a lot more support. So Amy Klobuchar could play that card, so to speak, and I think reap some benefit.
Bernie Sanders' black support has been growing steadily. Quinnipiac had him at 19%. Do you consider him the front runner now in South Carolina?
Well, he's certainly edging forward by a nose, you know, so to speak. But, you know, he's a comer. And, you know, Bernie Sanders had his own troubles. We remember in the last campaign, the last go-round, that Black Lives Matter confronted him. Bernie Sanders was not willing to talk about Black Lives Matter with any nuance and depth of perception. He has made valiant efforts to overcome that, to correct it, to try to address it in a meaningful and serious fashion. And so, again, given the practical inclination of many black voters who are not ideologically driven as much as sometimes issue concerned, but most especially appreciative of people who address the issues that black America has, while also forging connection with a broader mainstream of, you know, liberal sympathy, that will hopefully topple the man at the top right now. So, yeah, Bernie Sanders certainly has made an impressive gain, and will continue to do so, perhaps, and it's well worth watching.
The Mayor Pete clip that we played from his victory speech, saying Americans don't want to be pigeonholed as either for a revolution or for the status quo, how much do you think that's a mostly white mindset way of framing the political spectrum, and black voters are asking different questions, or does it largely apply across the board, in your opinion?
Well, it's probably a mixed bag. On the one hand, you're absolutely right that, you know, this is how it cuts in majority white populations, where, you know, we're either arguing about the revolutionary impulse of the progressive left wing that, you know, has health care for all in its sight, is trying to rearticulate the premise of national health care, that's trying to deal with the environment and fracking and the like, and that's trying to lay down the predicate for a revolutionary alteration in American culture, seeing a person like AOC, the congresswoman from New York, as the harbinger of the potential for those kinds of politics to make a real difference, to have a real foothold in America. For black people, I think that, again, given the kind of pragmatic philosophy that motivates so many black people, it's not about methods and means. It's not about ideological purity. It's about a commitment to making certain that we can overcome some of the traumas of the past and address them in a least sensitive fashion, but most especially of having the ability to put Trump out of office and to get the nation back on steady, on more firm ground or firmer ground. So I think that it's not that black people are oblivious en masse to some of the issues that percolate and that resonate in majority white circles, but they're far less inclined to hold the failure to live up to one's ideals, because very few people can ever do that. Presidents promise a bunch of stuff and never live up to it. Politicians always claim what they're aiming for, but rarely achieve. Black people have seen the gulf between the ideal and the reality. You know, T.S. Eliot said, between the ideal and the reality falls the shadow. Black people have often dealt in the shadows. They understand what it means to have, to want to grasp after something. You know, a man's aim should exceed his grasp, or what else is a heaven for, as the poet said, or a person's, you know, aim should exceed their grasp. So the reality is that black people get the distance between ideals and realities and focus on what can be practically done, what can you get in there and make a change for, and how can you get elected and what's your plan to do so. And listening to that, I think many black people will continue to vote the passions that motivate them for practical reorganization of American government at local and national levels that reflects what's doable, not what's revolutionary, but what's actually doable.
You mentioned AOC in that answer. Bernie's got the backing of three members of the squad, as you know, AOC and Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, all congresswomen of color. For the record, Ayanna Pressley, the fourth member of the squad, is a congresswoman from Massachusetts, and she supports Elizabeth Warren, her home state senator. But do you expect the three Bernie supporters to be seen as effective surrogates in South Carolina, or is the population there different in a way that would make them less receptive to these congresswomen from New York and the upper Midwest?
Yeah, I think you're right, the latter part. I think that there's some skepticism about, you know, how the actual application of the ideals will work in a political realm. It is not that black people are resistant to the message, appreciate the fire, appreciate the bigger, appreciate the uplook, the uplooking and uplifting rhetoric, but they also understand you got to get elected, you got to get into office, you got to have an option. And in that way, and to that degree, there may be some skepticism about what that revolutionary message would look like with three members of the squad and how Bernie would be able to implement that. What black, you know, voters for the most part are looking for are sturdy premises upon which to rest an argument for democracy and its expansion, and how the programs that are available, that are readily implementable, can be done in a fashion where they have a benefit for African American and other people. So again, practicable politics, pragmatic political orientations and perspectives rule the roost for black people far more than an ideological driven argument.
Nobles, you're on with Michael Eric Dyson and me. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Brian. Mr. Dyson, thank you so much, by the way, as a longtime fan, for the contribution to the African-American conversation and experience. For me, as an African-American millennial with two daughters, I'm between Warren and Bernie Sanders. The reason being is because, you know, to Mr. Dyson's point here, I feel it's a conversation and a question of progress to the machine or progress to the people. And with Elizabeth Warren, I do see the progressive values and her way to change the machine to make those into a reality. With Bernie Sanders, I do feel that he is definitely in the right place of where we need to go. But also from an aspirational standpoint, he has a lot of faith in the people, which I do as well. But it does that match where we are right now as an electorate? And in that regard, we'll find out. Get out the vote. I know the younger folks are being more involved now, folks of my age. But how much faith do you have in that? So if, you know, Bernie does get to be the president, God willing, he does, will we have enough support behind him to make some of the aspirational things that he's thinking into reality? As we get further in this primary process, I'm going to see how they even out that message to make things into reality. And that's what really I'm looking for to make my choice between the two.
Nobles, thank you so much for that call. Let me go right on to another caller. Anna Maria in Manhattan. You're on the air. Hi, Anna Maria.
Oh, yes. Good morning. Thank you for having my call. Yes, I'm going to go for Biden since the first day he decided to run for president. Now voting for Biden will be giving the green light to Trump to be elected, because all this impeachment, and he's not been the last thing that they did for him, anyway.
Why do you think Biden is the only one who could beat Trump? If I hear you correctly, that's what you were saying.
Yes, Biden will be because he has the Spanish people vote and the black people vote, and this is a man with experience, and he worked with Obama. And now, Buttigieg in the United States, he will never be elected now. Maybe in 20 years. We have to process.
Why?
Because I saw by Hallmark a commercial in Christmas time about two women giving to each other a gift, and they have to remove the commercial because people were so upset about that. Imagine, this is only Christmas, and then now the whole nation is going to vote for a gay man. No. Sanders, to me, is too old. He already has suffered a heart attack. He will not last 4 years, and 8 years less. And I know Biden is old, Bloomberg is old, but Biden looks old. Biden looks tired, and he's also like an angry person always.
You mean Sanders, right?
Yeah. Sanders. I'm sorry. Sanders is old. He will not last 4 years in less 8 years. He looks tired.
You think Biden looks less tired than Sanders?
Yes. And even Bloomberg looked better and physically.
Yeah. Okay. But Anna Maria, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much. Well, Professor Dyson, she went there with Buttigieg and the resistance to a gay candidate. What do you think?
Yeah, well, look, he's doing pretty well so far. And I think, look, Buttigieg is a man who understands that his gay identity is central to him, but he's moderate enough in his political beliefs, conservative enough in his moral orientation, that he's capable of acknowledging those who might be resistant to him, skeptical of him, and use that resistance and skepticism to teach America a profound lesson, not only about tolerance, but about overcoming their particular bigotries and biases to embrace a figure who might do a good job for them. This is why I think the comparison to Obama reigns. Obama with race, Buttigieg with sexual orientation, are moderate figures who understand the mainstream, who accept the fact that there will be skepticism and resistance, who speak directly to it, but in terms gentle enough not to indict the people who hold beliefs that are outside of appreciation for them or tolerance for them, but challenging them enough to suggest that if you give me a chance and you move beyond your particular limitation, you'll see that we have much more in common. And quite frankly, I think Buttigieg has been doing that quite effectively.
Do you think we see from this race any reflection of a kind of hierarchy of prejudices in American society, that a sort of clean-cut, veteran, Christian, white guy, even if he's gay, is now more acceptable to the mainstream than any woman or Barack Obama's presidency, notwithstanding, a candidate of color?
Yeah, it does suggest that, doesn't it? It does suggest that the real religion in America remains whiteness, that the real motive for so many things, unconsciously, often, happens to be rooted in a similarity of vision, a kind of simpatico that is unconsciously expressed, that is nevertheless a serious glue to hold together society. So, yeah, here's a guy that, you know, on the face of it, because of his sexual orientation, might occasion quite a bit of consternation. And yet, because he's been able to meld and fuse his particular political beliefs with the mainstream, he has mitigated the factor of his sexual difference as a negative to a large degree. And yet, you know, when you look at a Kamala Harris or a Cory Booker, you know, who were forced to leave the race quite early, relatively speaking, there was no kind of consideration for them. You know, the sense of difference between them and the mainstream was too hard to overcome. And think also not only about them, but think about, you know, the kind of statements that a Mike Bloomberg made about stop and frisk. And yet even black voters who were so hard on Kamala Harris, you're a cop, you were a prosecutor, you were doing horrible things against black people, some of those people, some of that voterate, that demographically rich black voterate, has been willing to accept apologies from Mike Bloomberg and overlook some of the more, you know, egregious and flagrant offenses that were, you know, occasioned under his own mayorship in New York. So it is quite interesting and intriguing, both outside of black America and from within it as well.
Anything on the gender piece of that?
Well, there's no question that, you know, again, a white guy, clean cut, you know, military bred, seems to be more upstanding than, you know, a senator like Elizabeth Warren, who's highly intelligent, manifestly committed to the betterment of the nation. Amy Klobuchar, you know, a moderate figure out of Minnesota who's been committed for years and years in the Senate, chafes at Buttigieg's assault upon, you know, Washington status quo. But these women have not so far been able to move the needle to the degree that Buttigieg has. And I think it does suggest that, you know, whiteness will overcome in Trump considerations of color and also of gender as well.
Let me touch on one or two other things real quick with you, if we can, from the race. In the Quinnipiac poll, Bloomberg was the number two candidate among black voters. He suddenly surged in that poll to 22%. So it was Biden 27, Bloomberg 22, then Sanders 19. But then yesterday, as you know, came that tape of Bloomberg defending stop and frisk in 2015 and saying things like, here's a quote from the tape, "We put all the cops in minority neighborhoods. Yes, that's true. Why'd we do it? Because that's where all the crime is. And the way you should get the guns out of kids' hands is to throw them against the wall and frisk them," unquote. How much of a game changer do you think this tape is going to be?
You know, and maybe unfortunately, I don't think a large one. First of all, the conservative moral values of masses of black people, they don't want to be complicit in any practice that would unfairly target their children. And therefore, of course, they would disagree with Mike Bloomberg on that. However, you know, given the sympathies and the understandings of many black people, I think they would say that was in the past. The man apologized. He said he was wrong. He went to a church and he confessed his sin. This is something from that era. Now, had this been recorded of him saying it 2 days ago, that would be a bigger problem. So I don't think it's going to be as much of a problem as some anticipated. I could be wrong. And I think that black people's willingness to work with people who may not disagree, may not agree with them, or who in the past were strongly opposed to them, is not something that's unfamiliar to black people. So I'm not certain that given the level of spending that Mr. Bloomberg is now engaging in, and spending in ways that traditional Democrats are not, on black media, spending significant resources there. So it's not simply literally about trying to buy this nomination. It's also understanding that black communities, African-American communities, have not been the recipient historically of the kind of, you know, largesse and monies that are, you know, that the country, that the party is awash in, that they have to distribute. And with Bloomberg's willingness to target African-American people, I don't mean to buy them out literally, but to understand that a resource base is a critical index of your commitment to people. And if you're willing to share some of those resources in historically underrepresented communities, that can only be a positive.
Last thing, then, as a segue from that, Tom Steyer. He only got 3% in New Hampshire, but he has spent almost all the TV advertising money spent so far by anyone in both South Carolina and Nevada. In Nevada, like 90% of the TV spots are Steyer's, from what I've read. So if Bloomberg is running a Super Tuesday strategy along the lines you were just describing, Steyer has been running a Nevada and South Carolina strategy, and they come first, and emphasizing racial issues in the televised debates. How do you see Tom Steyer as a factor in these next two races?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if he gains any traction. He's talking the right talk. He's saying the right things. But again, you know, for those who think black voters, oh, yeah, that's amazing. And I'm sure they do internally. They are grateful for Mr. Steyer saying it. But they're looking at electability even more than self-interest, or that they find their self-interest fusing with the conception of electability. Because if somebody can't get elected, they can't even begin to address some of the issues that black people have that will better be addressed under a Democratic president than a Republican one. So they're even willing to sacrifice purity and conceptions of absolutism in deference to a figure like a Bloomberg who may have a better chance of getting elected. And so that electability factor is not simply a crass metric evoked to substantiate that one candidate versus another has more pull or has that it factor. No, it's a very practical determination. To what degree is this person willing to tell the story about what goes on in black America and willing to support it with resources so that the blight and the hurt and pain and trauma will be addressed, mitigated, or removed?
And with that, we do turn our attention to the future. As we said at the beginning of the segment, it's not just that Iowa and New Hampshire always going first may be unfair to most Americans. It's also that they are such an unscientific sample of the country. So here comes South Carolina and Nevada. Here come everybody after that. And we thank Georgetown professor, New York Times contributing opinion writer, Professor Michael Eric Dyson. He's also the author of the new book, Jay-Z, Made in America. Thank you so much. We always appreciate the insight.
Thanks for having me, my brother.
And listeners, we want to invite you in on the conversation, too. If you've got a question about a national news item, whether it's something you want to know about the election or the Trump administration or anything else you think might fall under the national politics umbrella, give us a call and leave us a message with your name, where you're calling from, and your question. We'll collect those and keep them in our pocket for when I'm speaking with someone who can give you a good answer. The number is 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255, 844-745-TALK. See you tomorrow.